Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is City of Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. He's in the final year of his four-year term, and he'll be on the ballot for re-election this November. He holds the office as an independent. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back on with you, Grant. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And so I wanted to talk about three, I think, really sort of big issues right now for the city that have been in the media and I think are also important thinking about the city and its future. So the first one is the COVID vaccines. And there's been a lot going on with that. A lot has changed since when you and I spoke in the winter, that's for sure. And so the first thing I wanted to ask you is the supply of the vaccine now is robust, but the concern is that the demand is falling off and there are too many people who are, I guess the term for them is vaccine hesitant or vaccine reluctant, and, you know, for a variety of different reasons. I just, first question is, where's the city of Syracuse on the vaccination rate? Where are we? And are you pleased with where we are? How would you like to see it change?
Well, we're making progress, Grant, but not as quickly as I would like. The county has a little over 50% of our residents vaccinated. And when you look at 18 and up, it is around 67%. The city's lagging behind that. And I think that there are some good reasons for that. We do have a higher proportion of what would be considered harder to reach populations. And we are working very hard to reach them. And there's also a distinction to be made between those that are vaccine hesitant that have very specific reasons why they're concerned, largely related to health concerns, and those that for whatever reason just haven't gotten them yet. Again, for the harder to reach populations, what we're finding is when we go to where the people are, we're getting people vaccinated, but that requires it's time and labor intensive. That's why we've been doing so many pop-up clinics. And what we're also finding is since we've opened them up to walk-ins, we're getting more people. We were at Destiny USA last weekend, and we had a lot of vaccinations there. We were at Second Olivet Church yesterday with just a sign out front that said walk-ins welcome, and people are making their way in. So for me, it's getting at those individuals first that don't have a strong reason why they're not getting it other than it just hasn't been accessible to them. But then we also have the hesitant folks as well, and that's a big challenge.
It does seem like the appointment process was, for whatever reason, keeping some people away. Well, another question is, when you look at the rules and also the enforcement mechanisms for those rules for people getting vaccines, they're all over the place, depending on what organization or government you're looking at. So just a couple examples here. The State University System of New York is going to require students to be vaccinated, but they're not going to require faculty and staff. The California's requirement in the university system includes faculty and staff. And then you've got a place like the state of Florida where the governor has banned businesses from requiring customers to show proof of vaccination if they wanted to do that. And he's also banned state agencies from issuing vaccine passports, like the one I currently have in my billfold from the state of New York. So is the city of Syracuse doing anything along those lines to try to encourage more people to get the vaccine? Or are you thinking of something that, you know, might be even stronger than providing the vaccine, going to, as you said, to where the folks are?
Well, I think those examples that you gave are reflective of the challenge that we've had throughout this pandemic. There has not been a cohesive nationwide approach to dealing with the pandemic. I think it's gotten better under the Biden administration, but it's far from perfect. And so, as I've said from the beginning, there's no playbook here. So we are learning as we go. But you know, for the city of Syracuse, we're looking at it both as an employer and then as a local government. As an employer, we do legally have the right to require all employees to get vaccinated. We're not exercising that right. We are encouraging it. And we just put out some new masking guidelines that are consistent with CDC guidelines, which I think incentivize people to get vaccinated. If you're in your right office space and everyone is vaccinated, you don't have to wear masks. And so I think that we're going to see more of that. You know, I went to the Syracuse Mets first baseball game. There was two lines. There was the vaccinated line, and I had my, like you, I had my my Excelsior pass from New York State, that line went quick. Then there was the testing line, and that didn't go nearly as fast. So I think it is going to become increasingly inconvenient for people not to be vaccinated. And so again, I think we'll see those numbers continue to shift, but I wish it didn't come to that. Again, if everyone who is eligible to be vaccinated was vaccinated right now, we would be, I believe, very close to being largely done with the pandemic. So that's frustrating, but it's the reality that we're living in, and we're just doing the best we can to learn as we go.
Yeah, you mentioned the incentive structure there of having the two lines at the stadium. And there's another question then to flip it around I wanted to ask, which is instead of kind of pushing people, there is the other method of incentivizing, you know, giving them reasons for this. And there's a certain kind of social problem. I don't want to get too deep into social science here, but there's a certain kind of social problem with herd immunity, because herd immunity only gets achieved if enough individuals, as you just said, are willing to help produce it by being vaccinated. But then if we get to herd immunity, the people that didn't cooperate and didn't participate still get the benefit of it, because we've reached that stage. So we are starting to see incentive programs, I think, coming. You mentioned the two lines. I mean, in New York City, there's free subway passes. If you get vaccinated, there's free tickets to see a Yankees game, I understand. Onondaga County now has a free food and drink coupon book that they're giving out. Can you think of any incentives that the city of Syracuse might consider or initiate to help with? I mean, here's a couple I thought: maybe forgiving parking fines up to a certain point, or free parking vouchers, bus vouchers. Are you thinking of anything like that?
We are. Those are good ideas, Grant. And you know, I was thinking about what Buffalo and Erie County did with free beer with a shot, and that seemed to have worked. So you know, I think we're all experimenting, innovating, and yes, we are looking at options for the city. Like everything else with the pandemic, we've tried to be in lockstep with Onondaga County because that's where our health department is located, and so we're partnering with them on those programs. I mentioned we were at Destiny this past weekend, and some of the stores had incentives for vaccinations as well. So yeah, for better or worse, incentives do appear to be working, but I think we're gonna need to continue to iterate and innovate to make sure we're getting the right incentives for the right people.
I'm Grant Reher. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and I'm speaking with Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. Let me move to another topic now, but first, actually, on the issue of getting back to normal and, you know, incentives, I think you wanted to let folks know about the status of City Hall. Let me let you do that first.
Yeah, so beginning on Monday, City Hall will be officially open to the public. Now, we've maintained operations throughout the pandemic, but coincidentally, around the time of the beginning of the pandemic, we had a pretty big flood in City Hall that caused some pretty significant damage. It did give us an opportunity to do some pretty significant renovations, both specific to the flood, but also just to make City Hall more COVID friendly. So it's been frustrating for some of the folks that we serve, but when we open those doors on Monday, you're going to see a lot of improvements to City Hall. It's going to be more customer friendly. It's going to be safer. We're going to have a central point of access on Market Street. And I'm looking forward to having people back in the building. We've had staff, but it's just not the same without the public. So I encourage people, if you have business to do in City Hall starting Monday, come on in.
Great, great. So let me turn to another topic, and it's been in the media a lot. It's the Skyline Apartments. I'm going to assume most of our listeners know what I'm referring to there, but I'll mention a couple quick facts here. The problems there have been in the media a lot lately. The attention was energized and initiated, I think, by the recent murder of a 93-year-old former teacher there. The conditions sound really horrible, and apparently they've also been longstanding. So the building is owned by Tim and Troy Green in Skaneateles. There have been numerous complaints made about the building to the owners, and the city now has declared the building a public nuisance. And my understanding is that subjects it to greater public accountability. So let me ask you a couple questions about those apartments. First of all, You organized a public hearing on this building on, I believe it was Monday, May 10th. It's 2 days before the conversation we're having right now. What did you learn at that hearing?
Well, it reinforced everything that that we've seen firsthand and that we've been fighting now for nearly 3 years. The conditions in that property for far too long have been deplorable, and the tenants in that building deserve better. And they came out in force along with neighbors to say just that. So that hearing was part of our formal nuisance abatement process. We issued a nuisance abatement notice based on the number of qualifying arrests that have taken place on at that property, the most recent being the tragic murder of Connie Torrey. And that gives us additional leverage to hold the property owner accountable. There are a lot of problems with that property, and we've used literally every tool in our toolkit, from taking them to court for broken elevators to declaring the property unfit because of the unsanitary conditions and the broken elevators and the nuisance abatement ordinance. But the primary problem, the biggest problem, is security there. They have not done nearly enough to make sure that that property is secure for their tenants. So the nuisance abatement process gives us the ability to hold them accountable, to require them to institute more security in the building. What we've done so far does appear to be working. It's getting better, but it's not where it needs to be yet.
And an obvious question there that comes out of what you said. You said you've been battling them for 3 years, but clearly there have been new things that the city has done recently. So one obvious question is, why did it take as long as it did for you folks to ratchet this up to that level where the accountability mechanisms would be stronger?
Well, like I said, Grant, we've used every tool in the toolkit, and we've, you know, again, when we took them to court last within the past couple of weeks, that wasn't the first time that we did. Honestly, this is unlike any situation I've ever encountered, and many in City Hall have ever encountered. Don't get me wrong, we have a number of challenging apartment buildings, which was why we created our new home unit for high occupancy monitoring and enforcement. But to the lack of cooperation and compliance with the owners is really unprecedented. And so, you know, I think that we were using every tool at our disposal. We were getting improvements from time to time. But the reality is that the murder of Connie Torrey, I think, hit everyone in this community very hard. And it forced us to dig deeper and to get more creative and to try to find new tools, because the ones that we've been using just simply haven't been working.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with City of Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. We've been discussing the Skyline Apartments, and I wanted to just ask one more question about that before we move on to another topic, Mayor. And it's not the most important outcome from this issue, but I was curious to get your take on it. Do you think that all this is going to tarnish the legacy of Tim Green? It's apparently not the only building of this kind that the Greens own. And at least according to the story in the Post Standard, as I understood it, they've been getting more and more into this type of investment. Do you think this is going to have an effect on the way people remember him?
You know, Grant, I really don't know. And I can't, I can't focus on that. You know, we need to, sure, we treat every property and every property owner the same. We need to hold them accountable. I expect people, just because I'm the mayor, I expect people will hold me accountable, and I'm going to hold property owners accountable regardless of who they are.
Okay. All right. Well, let's shift now. And we've been talking about problems, not enough people getting vaccinated, Skyline Apartments. I want to shift to opportunities for the city now. And we have been doing on the Campbell Conversations an intermittent series of programs on the rebuilding and the redevelopment of the I-81 footprint downtown. And I'll have some questions about that. First of all, the nonprofit organization Blueprint 15 is taking the lead on this redevelopment process, and it's in a partnership with the city. It's following the purpose-built community model, which includes mixed income and also mixed use. Your deputy mayor is on the board of directors of the Blueprint 15. Your former commissioner of neighborhood and business development is now the interim executive director. One of the concerns that keeps surfacing in my interviews with people on this topic, experts and activists, is that whatever replaces the current footprint, which includes the Pioneer Homes, will ultimately displace the poorer residents. And more generally, the concern is that the structure and the features of this new development are going to be more thrust upon the residents rather than being derived from the community up. So I guess my first question, what's your perception of the public input process surrounding this process and this project so far?
I understand why people have concerns, and I share those concerns. We have a number of opportunities converging here. You'd mentioned Blueprint 15 and the purpose-built communities model. That would be happening irregardless of what's happening with 81, because the Syracuse Housing Authority has come to the conclusion that their existing housing portfolio in that area has reached the end of its useful life. And so they need to redevelop that area. The fact that we have 81 coming at the same time presents both challenges and significant opportunities. We've been very intentional in ensuring that we don't make the mistakes of the past, that we center our efforts around those living in that housing and in within the shadow of the viaduct. We recently secured a $1 million grant from Enterprise specifically for anti-displacement. But the reality is, people can only base their opinions on what has happened in the past. And what has happened in Syracuse and what has happened in communities all around the country is displacement and gentrification. So while sometimes it's frustrating for me to hear those concerns, because we have tried to be so intentional about ensuring that we don't make those mistakes again, until we prove it with our actions and with outcomes, people are understandably going to be skeptical. But we're just going to keep at it. We're going to make sure that those residents are at the table as decisions are being made. And I'm confident that we are going to do it differently this time and do it right.
You made a distinction that a previous guest, Lanessa Chaplin, made, which I think is important. I'll just repeat it, that there are two tracks here. There's the I-81 track, and then there's the redevelopment track. And sometimes I think it's easy to think of them as the same thing, but they are right. Different things. So on that track then of the redevelopment in Blueprint 15, the website for Blueprint 15 had until recently, I believe, listed a 4-month process, which was supposed to begin this month for the listening phase and the understanding phase of the needs of the residents, as well as the testing the ideas phase for the housing and the neighborhood with those residents. And that seemed to me to be very compressed. And I talked about that with a couple of previous guests. That seems to not be on their website anymore. And so I was wondering if you knew anything about the intended public input schedule at this point, whether the time horizon has been sort of expanded or is in the process of being expanded. Do you know anything about that?
I can't speak to that specific time frame and the reference on the website, Grant. What I can tell you is that community engagement has been a critical to this process from the beginning, and it isn't limited to just the efforts of the Blueprint 15 organization. You mentioned Lanessa Chaplin and her role with the New York Civil Liberties Union. They've done incredibly important, valuable work in engaging with residents that has been beneficial to this process. And we're going to continue to work with our community partners to engage the community throughout. There are residents on the Blueprint 15 board. So I think that we are taking the right steps to ensure that the community and specifically residents in this area are at the table for the important decisions. But it's a work in progress. And again, until we show a different outcome, I think people are naturally and understandably going to be skeptical.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. Well, let's talk a little bit more in detail about how this process might look going forward and how what mechanisms might be used to actually keep what has happened in the past with not just the things like the viaduct originally, but the Blueprint 15 has a history in this respect of displacing people. When you look at, or not Blueprint 15, excuse me, the purpose-built communities model, when you look at other cities. And so So first of all, do you have an idea of what you'd like to see regarding a right to return for the residents that are there? And how do you enforce it? You know, how do you keep people from getting boxed out when the new development comes in?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of doing it right is making sure that you're honest with people. And the reality is, and again, we're talking about two separate but related projects. When the 81 project happens, and when the redevelopment of some of the housing authority properties happens, there is going to be some level of, at least, you know, of temporary displacement.
Sure, there has to be. Yeah.
Right. And so you need to be honest about that, first and foremost. But then you need to make sure that for those that that are facing displacement, that, to your point, if they want to return, they have the ability to. And if they don't, that they have alternative options for safe, quality, affordable housing. And we're investing through our Resurgent Neighborhoods Initiative in new housing, new affordable housing throughout the city. So we want people to have options, but for those that want to stay in the neighborhood, it is my full intention to ensure that they have the opportunity to do so. And if they don't, then I think we fail.
I have a couple political type questions I want to try to squeeze in at the end, and we've got about 6 minutes or so. But let me stick with this Blueprint 15 and the redevelopment and the I-81 issue just for another question here. I don't think there's any question that you are very committed to this city. I mean, if you just look at the biography of your life, your story of your life. But what would you like to see there, if we could fast forward to the end of the redevelopment process? What do you actually see ultimately being created in this area realistically? Give us that vision.
Yeah, I mean, I think it should be reflective of our vision for the entire city of Syracuse, which is to be a growing city that embraces diversity and creates opportunity for all. So we are going to see investment in that area, and that's good. But we want to ensure that investment creates opportunity for all. So that means people, again, living within the shadow of the viaduct, benefiting from this investment. It's not just about protecting them from negative consequences. It's uplifting people. So people that want to be able to work on that project, that's why we're investing in our Syracuse Build program to actually get people to work. We want to see small businesses, local small businesses, benefit from the spinoff investments. We want people to be able to afford to live in that area. So again, using that purpose-built model, ensuring that there are mixed income and affordable housing opportunities. So it's growth and investment, it's opportunity for all, and inherent within all of that is embracing our diversity. We know that the communities that were disproportionately hurt by the original 81 project were Black and Brown communities. And so we need to be intentional in ensuring that Black and Brown communities and other marginalized communities benefit from this project. And so the vision, again, is a diverse, mixed use, mixed income neighborhood that is thriving and giving people, especially people that are already there now, opportunities for growth.
So shifting gears, I want to ask you a question. You're an independent, you ran as an independent, but I did want to ask you a question about the Republican Party right now. Get your take on this. There is a lot of fractures going on within the party, it seems like, around the question of just how much it's going to attach itself to Donald Trump and some of the untrue statements that he's made about the 2020 election, among other things. And there is a group of former Republican officials that are signing a letter on Thursday. They said if Liz Cheney is taken out of that leadership position, and they're going to try to form a breakaway party. I think they're going to call it the Rationalist Party. But anyway, what's your take of quickly what's going on in the Republican Party?
Well, Grant, as you know, I try really hard to stay out of party politics, not just for political reasons, but really, my interests lie in city government and the work that I do here. But like everyone else, I pay attention to what's going on. I do come from a family with a lot of Republicans, including my father. I've made no bones about my discontent with the Trump administration, and it does appear that that the party is having a bit of an identity crisis, trying to determine what it looks like without President Trump as president. But frankly, that's for the party to figure out. That's why I have always avoided being affiliated with the party, because I understand that for many it's a means to an end in serving in government. I have the privilege of not having to deal with that, and to just get to stay focused on my job and on the people that I serve, and I'm happy with it that way.
So just time for something really quick here. I am going to put you on the spot, but I want to try to do this. I'm planning on hosting a debate among the candidates for the Democratic primary in order to challenge you in November, at least the ones that are viable, running viable campaigns. And it would be neat to say, well, you know, the mayor has a question for you. I want to put you on the spot. You don't want to tell me the question now, because then the candidates will hear it, but we'll surprise the candidates with it. So can I get you to send me a question? Will you send me a question to them?
Let me think about that, Grant. You know, I think you're right to focus on the primaries, because that's ultimately going to determine who runs. And I think that candidates need to not be focused on me, but focused on the city and what they would want to see happen differently. So let me think about it. As my former assistant said, that's why you do what you do and I do what I do. You're the master interviewer. I'm just a lowly politician.
All right.
But consider the request made, and I'll get back to you.
Okay. All right. We'll have to end it there. And as always, I want to thank the mayor for his time. That was Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. Mayor Walsh, again, thank you for making the time to speak with me. And as I've been doing throughout the past year and this year, I want to wish good health to you and your family.
Thanks so much, Grant. Same to you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. Conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Mark Levonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.